KCSU FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today, I'm very excited to have on Luzevies van der Laan, who is a former Dutch parliamentarian, former member of the EU, who is joining us via Skype from Slovenia. And we are going to be having an extended discussion, not just of a variety of issues that are coming up right now in the EU, but particularly in one of Luzevies' main areas of focus, which is technology and democracy. And for those of you that have listened to Hearsay Culture regularly for the last, at least the last 2 or 3 years, I've increasingly had people on that focus on e-democracy issues, whether it's input processes, international trade, opening up trade negotiations, bringing societies together, including not only from a political perspective or a governmental perspective, but also from a commercial perspective. And I'm excited to have on Luzevies because her work spans so many of these areas, and I think she will give us a perspective on Hearsay Culture that we've not heard recently based upon her background. I met Luzevies a couple of years ago now at a conference not at The Hague, but in The Hague, on Innovating Justice, an organization called HEAL. And they had brought together both people in the field as well as scholars and people coming up with new and exciting technologies on focusing on the question of how we use technology to make not only our judicial system more responsive to the needs and interests of society broadly, but also generally how we share information in ways that are useful. And I was excited to be there because I met a number of really interesting people, including Luzevies at the conference, who all focus from a variety of perspectives and cultural backgrounds and really interests on this question. And so we were able to, at that conference, have a little bit of a discussion about these issues and a book that Luzevies is working on that we'll talk about a little bit. But I saw at that conference the ways that Hearsay Culture can be and do what I've wanted it to do since its inception in May of 2006, which is to bring communities and interests together that don't normally talk. And that's something that I'm very proud of having done over the last several years on Hearsay Culture, and this is another wonderful example of it. So by way of background, Luzevies is the vice president of the European Liberal Democrats. She is also a consultant on democracy and human rights issues. Her background, for those of you that are not familiar with Dutch or European politics, but in 1999 she became head of the D66 in the European elections. She became chairwoman of the Parliamentary Party, a member of the Parliamentary Party Board of the ELDR. In 2006, she was a leader within the Dutch Parliament. She's been heavily involved in the European Parliament on issues ranging from budget control to civil rights to women's rights, and also on broadly on justice issues as well as technology. She moved back and forth between the Dutch Parliament and European governments more broadly, and she was a spokeswoman for her party in the Dutch Parliament on foreign affairs, higher ed, justice, technology, European affairs, and gay rights. Since she left office, she has been consulting on a variety of these issues. She was also employed for a while in 2009 at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. She's an active writer, active in speaking and advocating on all of these issues, and she is joining us again via Skype from Slovenia. Luzevies, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So let me start off, particularly for an American audience, although the listenership spans outside of the United States. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your current focuses right now?
Yeah, well, actually, no, I grew up in the U.S. When I was 9 years old, my family moved to Washington, D.C., so whenever I speak English, people always assume I'm an American. I spent some time in D.C. and then in El Paso, Texas, and in New Mexico. And so I didn't actually make it back to Europe until I was 18. And I find, of course, because of that, that I tend to be bridging kind of between Holland, between the Netherlands and Europe on the one hand and the U.S. on the other. And whenever big cultural clashes, and there have been quite some, of course, in the past years, I try to explain one side to the other and try to make sure that the dialogue stays open. So it's got a benefit having this weird background. And anyway, so I did my law school in Holland, and then I went to Europe. And I think one of the things that I noticed when I was working at the European Commission, which I guess would be like being a diplomat but at European level, is that I didn't find the European Parliament very impressive. I thought there were a lot of people who were at the end of their careers, not a lot of energy, and it was quite easy for the Commission, which was supposed to be controlled by the Parliament, to run circles around it. And I thought that was bad for democracy, and I decided to run. And it was very funny, because I remember my mom said, "But European Parliament, that's for people at the end of their career. What am I going to tell my friends?" I said, no, don't worry, Mom. I'm going to change all that. And now, luckily, we see a lot more young people going into politics. I think the difference with politics in the U.S. is that in Europe, you don't have to be incredibly rich and do all this outrageous amount of fundraising in order to be elected. So you'll get more young people, you'll get more women, you'll get more people from diverse backgrounds. Because the only thing you need to do is to get elected is to be elected within your political party. And we don't, you know, I mean, when you hear about the just outrageous amounts of money that people who are running for Congress or the Senate have to raise, you think, wow, you know, that's just creating a system dependent on money. And where's that big money coming from? Well, from big business. So we instinctively don't find that very democratic. And in the beginning, when I used to address American audiences, they couldn't believe it, you know, 33 years old. And a member of parliament, but I think that's how democracy should work. You shouldn't have to. You shouldn't leave it exclusively to rich people, and I think that's what's nice about the European system. And luckily, there were a whole bunch of like-minded spirits in the European Parliament, and we ganged together and tried to make a dent in the status quo, which I think to some extent we really did, because the European Parliament has changed from being kind of an afterthought in this whole European creation to becoming a real serious power player. And of course we have, it's interesting because from my American educational background and learning about, you know, how the U.S. became a country and also the ongoing battles between what should be done at state level and federal level is a really good basis to understand Europe. Because, you know, of course, people joke about, well, when is Europe going to work together? And, you know, okay, you have one currency, but you speak all these languages and all that. I say, well, you know, you have to know where we're coming from. And every question that goes to the U.S. Supreme Court deals with the question, should this be done at state level or federal level? Well, we have the same thing, except that we come at it with different histories, different languages, and, of course, a history that goes back a long, long way. Okay, we used to kill each other, like the North and the South, and the U.S. used to kill each other. But there was a difference. And I think the this question of, you know, what should be done at the federal level and state level, or in our case, what should be done at the country level or at the European level, it's really interesting to see the parallels. And usually I throw into the, you know, I throw into the discussion, well, look, the Americans have decided to do this, you know, at one level. So they've been struggling with it for 200 years. They must be getting something right.
Do you find that having moved between national and international in that sense, governance, that there are structural impediments or benefits to getting these broad policy issues that we're going to talk about today through diverse bodies? Because we do have clearly here, and this is a debate that's been, you know, I think very interesting and has, it's slowly coming to fruition. All right, the question of how you bring either at the trade level a variety of countries together has a lot of power. Parallels to how in a given state, to take New York for example, you bring individuals from Long Island, from Manhattan, and from upstate New York, which is rural, and upstate communities which have farming and agricultural and other interests together around policy. Do you find a similar parallel having moved between the Dutch Parliament and the European Parliament?
I think one of the things I enjoyed most about being in European politics is that you find kindred spirits of people who share your values and ideas about, you know, what a future Europe should look like. You find them everywhere. And the idea that I would, you know, have more in common with Dutch people than with French or Germans is nonsensical. I mean, we have within the Netherlands, we have very conservative Protestant political parties, which would like to see, you know, women in the kitchen and definitely not getting elected, and very conservative values. I find myself having much more in common with a Maltese feminist or gay right activist even though Malta is a very conservative country, because we want to go in the same direction. And what I have found, and I found this throughout the world, is that there are, when you find people who share your values, then passports are not relevant anymore. And it also doesn't matter whether people are elected or working behind the scenes or whether they're activists or civil servants. I think it's the key is to connect all the dots and to try to make change possible. And the great thing is, of course, that we live in this wonderfully interconnected world where it goes so much faster and it's so much easier to do this and to find those like-minded spirits. The scary thing is that the other guys, the conservative forces that would like to keep us, you know, either where we are or to try to, whatever they may be, are also working together very well. And I remember, I mean, one of the issues I try to work on is, you know, women's rights and LGBT rights, as they're called these days. And, you know, a long time ago, it was just called them gay rights because it just shows, you know, how limited our thinking was. It's about equality. And, you know, the rallying point in the United Nations for the conservatives here is the Vatican working together with Saudi Arabia, Iran, well, Libya before when Gaddafi was still there. And so you see that nationality doesn't matter, religion doesn't matter. It's that they share the same values, which is that, you know, they want to keep in place a conservative patriarchal society. And I find that fascinating because if they can work together, well, then we should be able to work together to make the world a better place.
We're chatting with Luzavies van der Laan on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Luzavies, I mentioned in your introduction, and I want to, again, frame our discussion. The European model of government, which we're not going to get into the details of, has a party structure which mirrors to some degree the United States, but you've got a stronger green environmental political movement in Europe than we do in the United States. And liberal Democrats, of course, in the United States connotes, you know, through 24-hour media, a certain style of thinking as opposed to a political party and movement. So how does the liberal Democrat ethic fit into modern Europe today, because given your focus, and that will transition us into the discussion of technology and how these technologies work from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, I always have a problem with calling myself a liberal in the U.S. because there's so many people who associate that with the word tax and spend.
Yes. Yes.
Which is what we associate with socialism. and so, I mean, my party is called the Democratic Party, and within the liberal Democratic family, it's a broad church, just like you would find, you know, pro-choice Republicans or, you know, gun-toting Democrats. So, you know, we also have quite a broad family. And you would find kind of the real, what I would call market liberals, who want to have very little government, low taxes, lots of freedom for the market. And you would find parties like mine, Democrats 66, were set up in 1966, which focuses not only on sound economics, because we do think you should earn money before you spend it, which I think is a big distinction from a lot of the social democratic approach. But we also think that individual liberty is extremely important. And we don't think that people should be left to their own devices when they actually need help. And so you would find that in the American context, which is a lot more about having to take care of yourself, I think in the American context, all European parties would be considered deeply socialist because we believe in strong social security. We believe in access to public health. We think in good education to give people the same opportunities. So there we are just very center in that perspective. And I think that actually focusing purely on economics is not in tune with what's happening in the 21st century. I think if anything, the economic crisis has shown us that unregulated banking, unregulated economics, it just means that we're handing our tax money, our savings, and our economic future to the greediest, and it doesn't work that way. And you don't, I mean, it's just like if you're playing football, you know, you need a referee and you need a level playing field. If you're tilting the field and the referee is on the side of one or two guys, well, we all know who's going to score the touchdowns.
The focus that we have on Hearsay Culture, as you know, focuses on this broad question of technology today. And the notion of Hearsay Culture, as I can see, was that technology requires us, this was in 2006, and I'm going to ask you whether it's changed. Technology requires us to use our own background and experiences to assess the truth of what we're reading and the meaning of it, and then what to do with that information. And through, of course, the U.S. has history being what it is, we go back a couple hundred years. European history obviously goes back far further, and there's a lot more interaction at the state levels than we do here, where we can see the United States, as you know, as being a unity of different regions, but all under one flag. I'm curious to get your perspective again today, and we'll take a step back, on the role of technology as you've seen it in Europe, bringing together these diverse interests. And we can get, and I do want to get into the impact of what we know about the National Security Agency spying, use of technology and spying through it. But let's start there. I mean, how do you see technology playing today in modern Europe in affecting the goals that you've described?
Yeah. You know, I think in Europe, it's the language issue still separates us. So what you do is, of course, English is our kind of our new Latin. It's the language that most of us would speak together. And of course, if you have more languages, like French or German, it helps because, you know, when you go, whether you go interrailing and you're down in Greece and you run into people from all over Europe, wherever you go, it's great to be able to talk to each other. But I think the full potential of technology, be it, you know, the media or communications, is always going to be hampered by people who don't understand one another. Because I will not be able to read the Estonian press. I will not be able to follow Maltese TV shows. So there's always going to be that extra filter. And I'm very conscious of that now that I live in Slovenia. Slovenian is spoken by only 2 million people. I don't have a Slavic language as a background, so it's extremely hard to learn. So all my information is secondhand, even though I live in the country. And there's, sure, there's a lot there. There's English language online papers. Some people, bloggers are tweeting in English. And of course, I have a Google alert on Slovenia and in Ljubljana just to find out what's going on. But that only scratches the surface of what's really going on. And since all politics and therefore all decision making is still local, local in the sense of it's happening in Paris and in Berlin and in Copenhagen, and the leaders of the countries come together in Brussels to take decisions, unless you know what's going on in those 28 countries, it's very hard to try to make the system move. In a way, you could imagine that if in Hawaii and Florida and Montana, they were all speaking different languages, but when they get together in Washington to make decisions, you know, how would you know exactly what's happening in Hawaii and Montana, and what were the real reasons why this or that senator can't take that decision? So I think that, and this is why I'm a great fan of languages. I'm a great fan of, I think we should be teaching four-year-olds at least English and ideally already another language. I think at this point it probably should be Chinese. And it's a waste that when we know that little kids absorb languages, they don't have to learn them, they absorb them, that we don't already just, you know, throw this at them and they suck it up like a sponge and you're just giving them the gift of being able to use this technology, because what's the point if we don't understand each other? Sure, we can hook up with a bunch of people in China, but we won't know what they're saying.
Has the technology that we're describing here, the sharing information, of course, has its limits across boundaries. And we've seen over the last, you know, few years the challenges with regard to the euro and a unified system of currency. Has technology, in your view, been able to allow, even with the language barriers, a conversation to occur at these meta levels about jobs and money and national prosperity, which raises national issues in ways that wouldn't have happened absent this communication structure? I mean, I guess I'm wondering whether the communication structure has exacerbated differences between people that are now competing for a what seems to be a smaller pie, or whether, in fact, it's allowed for, notwithstanding the language barriers, more discussion of policy at a level that reaches resolution. What have you seen happening recently?
Well, what is interesting is that just the fact that we have agreed in Europe to work together on, you know, opening up the borders, making sure there's cross-border trade, getting rid of 28 sets of rules and replacing them with one, so that, you know, for businesses, it's fantastic. You know, you meet a certain norm, you get access to the whole market. So we've been doing that for a long, long time, and that means that you get together, whether it's the fisheries ministers who are meeting or the agricultural ministers or the foreign ministers, it doesn't matter. You sit together, usually in Brussels, and you talk. Of course, there's a press corps around that. There's lobbyists around there. You know, it's a huge, huge structure. But of course, when those ministers come out, they then again address their media. Now, I would say the olden days, but it's not that long ago, you would have a bunch of journalists who would write down, and then the next day would be in the newspaper. Now it's just being broadcast live. Everybody can pick up the live feed. You could be the correspondent to Brussels and still be sitting in Tokyo because you would, okay, you wouldn't be able to go to the cocktail parties and hear what's going on, but you would get a lot of the stuff. And so it becomes much more direct, and in a way that makes it easier to get a grasp of what's going on. On the other hand, I think we're all suffering from an incredible information overload, and we are much more desperately in need of people who can make sense of it and distill things out of it. And if you take, for example, a newspaper like the Financial Times, which does that, it just takes this incredible overload of information. I remember when I was spokeswoman of the European Commission, there was more than 20 of us, and my department would put out 4 or 5 press releases a day. So if you're one correspondent for one newspaper, it's hard to push through that. But if you have, whether it's Reuters or the Financial Times or others who are distilling that, on the one hand, it helps you make sense of it and get your democratic accountability, find out where to have the impact, how to work together. On the other hand, you don't have control over what they do. If their quality isn't good, if they're missing something, it's hard to get a hold of that. So, a technology is not the solution. Technology is just a different way of doing it, and it's still up to us to be critical, to be analytical, and to do something useful with all that information out there.
We're chatting with Luzavies Vanderlaan on KZSFM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. Let's talk about some of your perspectives on these issues and even some solutions. You've written recently about, and as a broad focus, redefining liberal democracy for the 21st century. And I think we've alluded to some of those issues, as I understand them, having read. But why don't we get into some of these issues from a technological perspective? From your perspective, how can we redefine liberal democracy, or even democracy as you define it more broadly, given the technological and social abilities and limitations that we have as humans today?
Yeah. Well, I think a wonderful example is what's happening in Ukraine. The connections with, Ukraine, I've got a bunch of Ukrainian friends. I could follow almost live through their Facebook and Twitter feeds what was going on in Maidan Square. And then if you combine that with, the news coverage that was coming in and what was happening in Crimea, it was almost like being there. And in a way, you almost don't want to turn off your, TV or your computer because, you feel connected with these people. These are people who desperately want to be a part of Europe. They're fighting, under a European flag. Putin, of course, doing whatever he feels like doing and nobody really having the guts to stand up to him. These are the defining moments in history. And I've called what happened in Crimea an Anschluss, with that direct reference to when Hitler did the same thing with Sudetenland. As far as we know, Putin is not Hitler, and you can never make comparisons to the Second World War. I understand that. But we should learn lessons from history and that you need to stand up to bullies. Now, what I found interesting about the whole Ukraine thing is also how quickly, through technology, we were able to expose the so-called nationalist thugs as being Putin operatives. I mean, these guys, first of all, they were very nicely dressed. They had great uniforms. But if they left their shirts unbuttoned, they had Russian military T-shirts underneath, which are the great, very recognizable blue and white stripe. Mm. So within hours, it was clear that this was all being organized from the Kremlin. And everybody knew. And that I find fascinating, because it exposes dictators, it exposes what's going on. I think another interesting example is Erdogan of Turkey, who of course took Twitter offline for a while because he didn't like what they were tweeting about him, which is a classic dictatorial ploy, but which of course doesn't work. And so we have this ability on the one hand to expose threats to democracy, to expose dictators. But the next question still comes back to, what do we have the political will to do something about it? Because it, of course, it's embarrassing to these guys. And of course, it puts them in a corner and makes it more difficult for them to say, oh, we were just protecting those Russian speakers, or we were just doing this or that. But if at the end of the day, they still get away with it, doesn't it just make us more cynical? Doesn't it, people think, so all this is happening and nobody's willing to do anything? So in the end of the day, it does come back to, what values do we stand for and which ones are we willing to stand up for?
And I should note that we're recording on April 15th for airing on April 16th. With regard to the Ukrainian issue, if we're redefining democracy, one of the articles I read about a month ago now was in a New York Review of Books pointed out how the administration within the Ukraine was attempting to spin the protesters, right, the pro-European protesters, and it was very interesting. I want to get your reaction to it. The article pointed out that for internal consumption, the government was defining the protesters basically as Jews. And for external consumption, they were being painted as Nazis. And it was very interesting that in the midst of this technological change that we are witnessing and that we are experiencing, that government felt capable of having an internal and an external message, precisely for the reasons that you've described. And I'm curious to get your reaction to those facts, and maybe you know the facts differently. But what is your reaction to that model of, if you want to call it a model, right, of governing or of control of information?
Yeah, it's interesting that that despots and autocrats still think they can do it and that they can get away with it. And I think to a certain extent they can. I mean, first of all, we have to be really realistic. Not everybody is tech savvy. Not everybody is plugged in. And a lot of people don't know which information to trust. I mean, if you're in the U.S., you're only watching Fox News, you'll have a different view of what the world looks like than if you're also tuning into the BBC or Al Jazeera. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And I think people sometimes do want filters, and they, because the changes around us are so tremendous and so overwhelming, when someone comes along and gives you the easy version and the version which blames somebody else so you can make sense of it all, we would like to embrace that rather than face the truth. So I think technology has forced the autocrats to up their game, but also the rest of us, the Democrats, who are trying to break through it. And I still think it's embarrassing for the, like, for example, what's happening in Bahrain. You know, I retweet things from the Human Rights Center in Bahrain all the time, just because I really think the world should know what's going on. And I know the focus is somewhere else right now, but it's still outrageous what's happening there. And when the next crisis comes along, we shouldn't turn away from what's happening in Syria. You know, and technology is a way to keep that on the agenda. The risk that I see is that people think if they've tweeted it or liked it on Facebook, then that's the extent of their responsibility. And it shows how committed they are. And then the next tweet they'll send is that, you know, that they're now enjoying a great dinner with their boyfriend. That, I think, is a big risk, that it gives us a certain sense of, because we feel connected and we did something, that thereby our responsibility is less. And that's, again, goes back to, you know, what do you do with the technology? What do you do with that information? And that is something where, if we could then all vote on it or put the pressure on, that's really the next step. And I, what I find very impressive is that when you get, for example, I get the updates from the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And what they always have is, besides the update that they give, which is always fascinating because I can follow the whole sexual rights debate in the U.S., they always say, if you want to do something, you can send this letter to your congressman, or you can pay here, you can do this or that, so that the next click, it's not just about liking and sharing, but that the next click is actually action. And I know in America this seems to work much better than in Europe, because there's a tradition of people reaching out to their congressman or their senator who have to listen, because if they want to get reelected, they know that these are influential organizations and that if you take away a woman's right to choose, you're going to probably pay an electoral price, and you should. In Europe, this is not as strong. And one of the things I try to consult on is I try to tell especially non-governmental organizations that they need to use this technology not just to raise awareness and to get support, but to take the next step, which is to really have concrete political action. And that also means sometimes taking on the establishment. And it may not be nice to send out an email to your member saying, look, you know, we gave the Christian Democrats a chance on the past 10 key human rights issues. They voted wrong. We really don't think that you should, you know, reelect them. Okay, that's going a bit far for some organizations, but I think that's what they're there for. They need to name and to shame and to make it easier for us to take that technology and then to really change things, because otherwise we're just getting away easy.
We're chatting with Luzavies van der Laan on KZSU FM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stamford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stamford.edu or go to our webpage at kzsu.stamford.edu. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. Let's focus more specifically on these challenges as you have written about and are focusing on, involving xenophobia and really this anti-human positioning of an increasing, it seems, number of people that are starting to have again some electoral result. You've mentioned several areas where these issues are arising, and part of your efforts through the Liberal Democrats is to focus on these issues. And I'm curious if, in light of what you just said about the limitations of technology to actually get accountability and not just transparency, right? Not just a like, not just a tweet, but some effort at holding elected officials accountable, that the technology as we have it today is capable of taking on the deep-rooted xenophobia, which unfortunately goes back in all human beings quite a long ways.
Yeah. You know, it's a really interesting question, and I think we're going to see something very interesting in the upcoming European elections. So the elections are on the 22nd of May, and in some countries, and in other countries they have to have them on Sunday, so it'll be the 25th of May. They're going to be held in all 28 European member states, and they're going to elect a new European Parliament, which is going to be making legislation which affects more than 500 million people. It's really a big deal, and they'll be elected for 5 years. What we expect is a rise in the vote for the xenophobic parties. It's really going to be an eclectic mix. So you have kind of racist, xenophobes, anti-Brussels, anti-European, anti-establishment. So it's a strange mix. In Greece, you have both the very left-wing people who just feel robbed through the economic crisis, but also right-wing mobs that go through the market, and anyone who has a different skin color is going to get beaten up. In the Netherlands, in my country, we have Geert Wilders, who is what's kind of made a name for himself as being very Islamophobic. But he's also a very keen supporter of Israel. But he works together with Marine Le Pen, whose father is a known anti-Semite. So it's a very strange mix, but I think what they managed to do, I mean, if you look at it democratically, they're managing to tap into popular resentment, a feeling of disconnect with politics and with politicians. But at the same time, rather than coming up with solutions, they fall back into the old, well, let's blame the foreigners, let's blame the Jews, let's blame the Muslims, let's blame the Eurocrats, let's blame whoever we can blame. And the only answer they seem to come up with is, well, let's all pull the borders back up, bring back the national currencies, and close ourselves off. You know, it's as if you would kind of say, okay, Texas is now going to become independent, and you pull up some walls and bring out a new Texas passport, and that's gonna solve it all. So it's a challenge, I think, for what I would call mainstream politicians, because on the one hand, democracy is a powerful voice, and if people are this disconnected with mainstream politics, you need to sit up and listen. You need to take them seriously and make sure that they have another place to go besides people, you know, who want to just break down the house. And so I'm hoping they'll come to us because we want to rebuild the house. We know there's a lot of things wrong with the house. So, but rather than breaking it down, let's make sure it actually works and that we're comfortable in it. But the easy thing, well, you know, elections are all about fear and greed. So you make them afraid of the foreigners and you make them afraid of their pensions. And that seems to be much more effective than trying to gather progressive, pro-European, open-minded people together, which is where I think technology has a key role to play. I mean, if we can't use technology to show what unites us as Europeans and what we share, then we're really missing an important opportunity to bring all these diverse cultures together. And then we're giving them a free ride, the extremists.
You've done some interesting work recently in dealing with issues of corruption and the technological impacts on it, both in Albania and in Kosovo, including in Albania with one of U.S.'s former presidential candidates, Howard Dean. What was your and Howard Dean? I should remind people, at least in the U.S., was really the first major party candidate who used technology effectively to bring together a pretty remarkable set of supporters with the help of Joe Trippi, who's now made his name as being the person who does that. So I'm curious, again, given that work both with Dean in Albania and in Kosovo, which is yet another country that has this terrible history, if you've gleaned any insights that would be useful in framing these issues and addressing them.
You know, it's interesting because compared to the U.S., when it comes to running elections with technology, Europe is so incredibly far behind. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, part of it, I guess, is also a good thing. We don't allow data mining. We mm-hmm. have privacy in Europe.
Yes.
So, you know, if you can't, you know, mine everybody's data, then you don't know how they're going to vote. And so you don't have this really targeted information. And I have to say, I actually like that. There's something to be said. And I remember I called up the Dutch tax service the other day and I said, look, I have a question and I'm not in Holland. Can you help me out? And they said, no, sorry, I don't have access to your information. I said, well, if I give you permission, they said, nope, I don't have the clearance. I thought, that's good. There's something nice about that. That guy just can't go looking into my tax returns. But there's a part of the U.S. technology that we cannot apply simply because we have privacy laws. Having said that, I think that because for example, the Liberal Democrats in the United Kingdom, they just do it the low-tech way. They knock on someone's door, and then they ask them the questions, and then they enter them into a database. And if you put that together with the results, the electoral results per region, well, you get a pretty good indication of which neighborhoods vote for which party. You can also do that, but it's a lot more difficult than if you could just buy the information from Google or whoever. Now, moving further south in Europe, Albania, Kosovo, much lower internet penetration. Mm-hmm. Poverty is a huge problem. And so it was really fascinating walking around Albania, especially with Howard Dean, who I have to say I'm a huge fan of his. He's a powerhouse and he's got all his values in the right places. And I told him if you ever run for anything again, I'll come and campaign for you because he's a gem. And I think what's fascinating about being in a country like Albania is that you still have that real old style politics of, you know, the big man goes into the village. There's a lot of clientelism. You know, he'll arrange for the jobs. If you join the party, you'll be able to. So it's really old style, and I hope they can use technology to break through it. And I suggested actually to the Kosovars, it's quite interesting that in India, they are using anti-corruption apps. So you can actually, you know, you have an app and you put into it how much of a bribe you pay to whom and why. So you can always see kind of the going rate, you know, what is your speeding ticket going for and a doctor treatment and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But it also, it provides a really interesting insight into the culture. Now, in Kosovo, they're not there yet. Now, of course, not everybody will have, you know, especially the people who are paying these bribes and, it's so much part of the culture that you need to really break through it. And they're going to start really low tech with hanging up posters in hospitals that say the doctor already gets paid. You do not need to pay him on top of your normal bill. Hmm. You do not need to pay to get treatment. Hmm. They are going to hang up posters in universities to say the professor has a salary. You do not need to take his private tutoring in order to get a passing grade.
Wow.
Yeah, it is really that basic. I work a lot with young people. So I tell them they should look at these apps. They should look at developing them because I do think it helps if you can in total anonymity record what's going on. It is an incredible, powerful tool also for policymakers to say, wow, you know, we heard about these professors, you know, and their extra tuition, tutoring. And the way they make extra money. But if you can really have people report about it and you get the facts, the figures, ideally, of course, the names, maybe record even what's going on, it should be easier to tackle it. But it's so ingrained in the mindset that you also need to have leadership, which says, look, this is completely unacceptable, and we will not, you know, we will not stand for it.
Elizabeth, we're getting near, and this is a fascinating discussion, and which is why it pains me to say this, we're getting near what I call the unfair portion of the show. This is when I start asking you questions that you might need more time to answer thoroughly, and you're not going to get it.
Fair warning.
Yeah, this is my effort to be transparent. And so I give you a heads up. These issues that we're focusing on here, of course, and I've left this, you know, the proverbial 900-pound gorilla. I haven't asked it yet. Now I'm going to ask it, because it would be certainly negligence, and perhaps malpractice on my part if I didn't ask you this. So, you know, each day, as, you know, maybe it's slowed down to every few days now, we're getting more information about, National Security Agency's efforts to, and I'll let you characterize it. I'll just say destroy the internet. I think that's increasingly what seems to be happening, at least an internet that we have confidence on in terms of privacy and security and so forth. And even with the stories that have been made public and then been altered, it seems quite clear that the NSA has made a serious and successful effort in controlling vast portions of the network for its own gain. So I've loaded the dice here, although I think that view is certainly shared by many, but there are others who would say that the NSA activity is justified from a security and anti-terrorism perspective. But I'm going to ask you, not as much to characterize the behavior, although you're welcome to, but to talk about its impact. So we can start there. So what's your take on what we know about the NSA's behavior? Of course, we've also found out that, not surprisingly, other intelligence agencies outside the United States have engaged in similar efforts. What's your overarching take on what's happening?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, because I have for a long time been very critical about Europe in the way that it hasn't taken an independent stance. I was in the Dutch parliament when the invasion of Iraq took place. And it's interesting how, you know, Europe, with a couple of exceptions, were like, oh, well, if the Americans are going in, we need to be there. And I think, in a way, because I'm an optimist. I look at things optimistically, and I think the general outrage in Europe at what is happening to privacy around the world, what the NSA is doing, I hope will also be a rallying cry for Europe to be more self-confident in these issues, and to see that we have very diverging values in this regard. Maybe also because we have different histories. And that we don't need to blindly follow where the U.S. is leading. And of course, there are other areas where we have very, you know, things are very different. You know, in Europe, we don't carry guns. In America, that seems to be like a religious right for everyone. So there are a lot of things which are where we diverge, but we need to also grow up. You know, comes a point where I think we as Europeans have to realize that we have to think about the kind of world we want, the kind of society we want, and then to be ready to stand up and say, sorry, America, but we don't really think that this is the way forward. Now, I used to be spokeswoman on justice it was after 9/11, so one anti-terrorism measure after another came in. A lot of them, I would say, almost dictated by the U.S. Now, of course, democracies officially aren't dictated, but, you know, that's the reality of the situation. And so I have to, it was hard to balance to see what actually works. And one of the things I noticed is that politicians love things that look tough and impressive and, oh, look at everything we're doing. And of course, the moment you ask them, does it really work, and how many terrorist attacks did you prevent, et cetera, et cetera, well, they can't tell us, because it's national security and it's a secret and it's, they have to protect this and that, whatever. And as the party leader, I was privileged to the national security briefings, the secret ones. And then I said, well, now we have a secret briefing. I have the clearance. So tell me. And I was not impressed by the information. I mean, there was really nothing there that I thought, wow, you know, oh, I would gladly sacrifice my privacy for all the security I'm getting now. And I think what we need to do much more is to go back to the root causes. I mean, terrorism is serious. There are a bunch of very dangerous individuals who would like to cause as much grief and death and destruction as possible. And we need to know how to deal with them. But, you know, why do we want to not let these terrorists win? Because we want a certain kind of society. And if we're then destroying that society with the idea of destroying the terrorists, aren't they winning in a certain way? And you know, to take away the you know, there's been some wonderful studies done also by American universities about what ends terrorism. And terrorist groups don't function anymore when they have no more public support. And, well, let's do that. Let's focus a lot more resources on that. And, I mean, I'm afraid we're going to have a new generation who are so used to not having any privacy that, you know, whether they put their own nude pictures on Facebook or someone else does it. But, I don't think we should accept that. It is something extremely important. And, you know, Americans may trust that their government is the best government and will never do anything wrong with it. But these rules will stay along for a long, be around for a long time. And we've seen what happens when you can twist these rules. And in a way, you know, I'm a fan of the American series Scandal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, besides that, it's, you know, of course, extremely out there, but it's got some great acting. I think Scandal is just a wake-up call to everybody about the extent of technology. Wow, they're listening on every conversation. They can send, you know, text messages on your behalf. They know everything about you. And I think, if anything, that show has hopefully helped us, you know, wake up a little bit more to that there's nothing private anymore, and that we really need to start defending what we believe in.
Now, Elizabeth, let me ask you, particularly in light of the erosion of privacy, even notwithstanding the privacy directives in Europe, which in a sense really are a model for the world in terms of a meta analysis. When both current and former NSA officials have been asked about these programs, I've noticed one theme coming out of their comments that I want to get your reaction to. And when they are pushed on these issues, and I've seen this at the National Press Club, but also in academic conferences, there's a smirking response, which basically is, we find it amusing that the Europeans are so interested in privacy now. Okay, and I'm giving you that pushback question because it's interesting to me to see how the NSA is approaching this issue, which to me has been increasingly less about look at the benefits, as you're alluding to them, or that we might have from this process, and rather almost an argument saying everyone's doing it, and therefore the technology is not what, at least my take on it, the technology is not what you think it is. What's your reaction to this? And again, I know I'm paraphrasing this, but to this, yeah, this reaction.
No,
I
think it's interesting. I always like the, you know, everyone's doing it. Well, everybody used to do, you know, slavery and discriminating mm-hmm. against women and mm-hmm. witch burning and whatever. So I think that, but I think the key thing here is that, you know, we in Europe have, I think, much more of a hands-on experience, but with what happens when a government has this monopoly of information, and when you have no privacy whatsoever, and you know, if you there more and more movies are coming about what was it like, you know, in these totalitarian regimes, and it's interesting because, you know, the Czech Republic, Poland, you know, Lithuania, all these countries that were, you know, like the Baltics, you know, really annexed into the Soviet Union, or countries that were part of this sphere of influence. I think it's, you know, the books we've read, the movies we've seen, it's so much more part of our culture, how scary it is, and how easy societies can fall apart, you know, when people abuse these things under their control. And I find it fascinating that Americans, who have a much greater dislike of government than we do, and who don't want to pay taxes, who there's much more of this, you know, the government shouldn't be anywhere, that they almost give it like a free ride when it comes to issues as fundamental as privacy. And in a way, we have the opposite. We trust governments. We love paying taxes. We think the government should take care of all kinds of things. But we really like to have them stay out of our business. And I think the key thing here is to keep talking about it. And I would like to see a lot more politicians being at least angry, but be inquisitive, try to find out what's going on. And, you know, maybe a lot of these guys at the NSA, I'm sure they deeply believe that they are saving us from disaster. Well, fine. But then let's keep asking the questions and tell them, you know, ask them if this is really what works. But I think we also, as Europeans and Americans, need to realize that there is no such thing as 100% safety. You know, you had all these amazing things going on, and you still get, you know, the attack on the Boston Marathon. You have so many, we cannot live in a completely safe world. You know, you can put as many signs, don't run at a pool, but some kid is going to fall and break his nose. And then, you know, do you sue the pool or do you say, look, you know, don't run, you fool. Mm-hmm. It's part of life. And I think we also need to stop demanding from our governments 100% security, and to look at other ways to make the planet safe.
And so there, you couldn't give me a better lead. And like I said, this is the unfair portion of the show, Lucivi. So now I'm going to ask you, what do you see as very quickly? And I do want to ask you as a last question about the book project you have. So maybe you merge the two. What are those options as you see them today? The challenge between security and privacy versus technology. What do you see as potential solutions? And perhaps that's a lead in to tell us a little bit about, the book project that you're working on. And the one that certainly was among the impetuses for me having you on the show.
Yeah. No, it's a, you know, this is, I think, there is no simple answer. And I think this is one of the honest things that we have to say as well. You know, I can't say, look, if you vote for me, then, you know, I'm going to solve poverty. I'm going to make you rich. I'm going to do, no, of course not. I mean, I think we have to be very realistic in that as well. I think it's very interesting what happened in New York, where, you know, poverty and equality became really serious issues. Which is a real sign of the times, because a lot of people are afraid for the future, and it could be physical security, but it's also financial security, and these are huge questions. I mean, do we want a materialistic society in which all we care about is making more money than our neighbors, or, and I think in a way, Europe, and this is what one of the things that I want to address in my book. I think Europe has a special responsibility in this because we do manage to get certain things a little bit better than the rest of the world. One of them is what I would call work-life balance. I mean, I'm horrified when I hear that my American friends, 1 or 2 weeks after giving birth to a baby, they're back at work. That's ridiculous. I mean, that is so unhealthy for them and for the baby, but also for society, because you create a complete disconnect. And I'm sorry, but that just makes a hole in your soul that I don't think any amount of consumerism is ever going to fill. And you know, I really wonder why, you know, if people, you know, in Europe, we have all this maternity leave and all this other stuff. We seem to have less obesity and less, you know, other problems. I would love to find a connection between those and see, you know, how that works. The key thing about a democracy is we can keep on talking about this. We can keep on finding what works and what doesn't work. I think invading Afghanistan and eradicating drugs didn't help at all in making Afghanistan a safer place. I'm really glad the elections went well. I think in a way that was a victory over the Taliban because the Afghans did it themselves. And I really wonder if we hadn't gone around kicking in doors and you know, being a bunch of Westerners who knew better, whether this process couldn't have been much more homegrown and we could have done it differently. I followed the North African revolutions quite closely. And I think one of the risks there is that people thought, okay, we kicked out the dictator and now things are going to change immediately and we'll all be, you know, prosperous and it'll be stable. And I think one of the things we have to tell them is like, you guys, a democracy is not something that grows overnight. It's not George Bush hanging a, you know, job well done or whatever, he hung on the boat and said, you know, now we're done and there have been elections and that's democracy. This is about, it's a process that works every day, that, you know, it's like tending a garden. You know, you turn around and there's weeds again, and that flower that bloomed so well last year didn't bloom again. I think people like you who make your show are a key part of democracy. You know, you got to be that mosquito buzzing around and bugging people, because otherwise people in power just get it too easy. And what I want to write about also is about these progressive forces, people who want to work together, using technology, using personal contacts to keep on working to make that democracy bloom for as many people as possible.
Ludovies van der Laan, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. This is, as I mentioned, the tip of the iceberg. I would love to have you on in the future and to continue this discussion.
It'd be a pleasure.
I invite you back. These issues are, as you point out, are not only not going away, but are going to become increasingly challenging. On the other hand, I share your optimism that through just careful thought, human beings can solve these issues. It is the impetus behind the show, and it's the reason reason why I focus so heavily on technology policy. The saying truth will out, I think, ultimately bears a lot of credence today. So thank you for joining us on the show, for educating my listeners, and I'll look forward to chatting with you in the future.
It was a great pleasure, and if people want to get in touch with me,
please,
via Twitter or Facebook, I'd love to hear some feedback. People might have good ideas on how some of this thinking can be progressed. We can only do it together, and it's great to be kind of meeting through all this technology, meeting new people who hopefully share my views and values, and we can work together to make the world a better place.
Wonderful.
Thanks a lot for having me on, David.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm in the process this week of putting together the schedule for this quarter on Hearsay Culture. There's a number of interesting guests coming on, including one, Professor Laura Rizel, who's written on communication and political communication at the international level, who's going to be on the show soon. And other guests that at this point I was going to lay out the schedule, but because I am still finalizing it, I think I'm going to leave it, particularly as this show is going to be airing Wednesday, April 16th. Look for the schedule to be posted by the end of this week. I am excited again to mention that Professor Julie Cromer Young from Thomas Jefferson School of Law has joined us as a blogger who's going to be writing on procedural issues in intellectual property as well as technology, and that we will be able to have those discussions continue at the blog level as the podcast continues to grow. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show again Wednesdays this quarter at 2 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU FM Stanford, or you can stream it at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show after it airs on KZSU by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to hearsayculture.com, or by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, where you can get not only all 209 previous shows of Hearsay Culture, but as well as the upcoming guests and speakers at the Center for Internet Society. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.